Hello and welcome to the Leaders in Supply Chain and Logistics podcast. I am your host, Rado Palamariu, Managing Director of Elkut Global. Our mission is to connect the supply chain ecosystem in Asia and globally by bringing forward the most interesting leaders in the industry. And today, it's our pleasure to have with us Lorenzo Fornaroli, who is the Senior Director, Global Logistics and Supply Chain for Huawei Technologies. Lorenzo has 27 years of experience with multinationals and startups in the high-tech, FMCG, industrial, fashion, and retail sectors. And in Huawei, he's an executive advisor on strategy and global operations, sharing knowledge to improve supply chain performance and leadership behaviors with a focus on continuous growth around digital transformation, cultural awareness, and different operations matters across different regions and different functions. Prior to his current role, he had P&L and leadership experience across supply chain roles also in Italy, UK, and Switzerland. And he also is a member of the MIT Technology Review Global Panel, providing input upon request topics around business and technology. Lorenzo, pleasure to have you with us today. Thank you for joining.
Thank you, Rado. Pleasure to be here.
Super. And now just to kind of, we've had a lot of interest for this podcast, a lot of questions, a lot of people asking different types of, different types of information. And of course, if we are to speak about the elephant in the room, Huawei is in the middle of, a little bit of the spotlight between the trade war currently going on between the US and China. Just to pre-frame also to our listeners, of course, you come from the supply chain side. So we will focus on the questions that have been addressed on the supply chain aspects of the business. So, there's other questions that maybe are a little bit more business related than for that. We leave the corporate communication side of Huawei to tackle it. And if we are to start with the first question, which came from one of our closest listeners, and he was wondering, and again considering the current situation with the US, what strategies do you at Huawei deploy to mitigate this supply chain risks, which are obviously arising from the current trade war and from future trade war, of course.
Okay, Rado. So thanks for the introduction. I think this has been, and it's been still, a good learning curve, a good exercise internally in Huawei, because we are really taking this as an opportunity to demonstrate our core strength in supply chain and our core ability in understanding what are the biggest threats and challenges that we are facing, like any other companies we could. So we're looking at different aspects of this. We're looking at the risk management side, so contingency planning, which means how do we continue to ensure uninterrupted supplies to our customers. We're looking at understanding how can we remain a solid company operating in business with a stable risk-free environment. So we're looking at understanding the lever between the leverage, or let's say between in-house capabilities versus outsourced capabilities. We're looking at compliance, because when we are in the current context, we want to be even more confident with the compliance of our operations. We are revisiting, we've actually mapped our network as well, understanding supplier base in terms of manufacturing, supplier base in terms of logistics suppliers, supply base in terms of physical distribution of our goods, both on the inbound and on the outbound, so coming in from suppliers and also outbound shipments to customers. We're looking at the physical distribution and understand what are the areas where we can have an impact, what are the areas where we need to consider how we can increase the levels of control of our operations, what are the areas where we need to be more cautious and understand if there's a risk which potentially would impact our business. And so we've put a lot of efforts, and we still are putting a lot of efforts, in mapping our internal processes, like I said, both in terms of physical distribution and information sharing, so that we continue to be ahead of the game and try and understand what other risks could come. And we're building a lot of what-if scenarios. We're building a lot of hypothetical solutions to make sure that if plan B doesn't materialize, do we have a plan C? Do we have access to a plan C? Do we have the right communication standards in place? We have the right levels of suppliers who can continue to help us to provide uninterrupted supply. So it's a very complex work, but at the same time, a very good learning experience, especially also from my side, because you really understand how you can map the complete network and build in your study, in your solutions, a lot of hypothetical scenarios and build a backup solution for that. So that's prompting us to be very alert and very ready for the occurrence of alternative solutions in case we were to have to put them in place.
Yes, I mean, if anything, this I think there have been countless discussions with this ongoing trade wars going on. If anything, probably at the end of this or already the kind of side effect of this trade discussions, friendly or unfriendlier, will be that that a lot of supply chains will be much more agile at the end of it and are becoming more and more agile because, you know, you have to. And I know there was some good news for you guys last. I think it was last night when there was the announcement from the US that now the US providers are allowed to sell parts and components into Huawei again. But I'm just wondering. I mean, is it possible to? And I think that was actually the question also from the listener. He kind of finished it off in that note. Is it possible to totally mitigate any sort of risks like these trade wars? Or I don't know, a typhoon or a strike. Is that even possible, or you know, or how much can you do? Like, it's like 98%, you know, a risk mitigation, or how would that work in your mind?
I mean, you know, you bring it up a good point, right? Because there's obviously the famous question: you don't know what you don't know. So, how ready are you? Can you say you're ready at 98%? If you say 98%, for example, it means you know what 100% is. So if you know what 100% is, then it means you will know exactly anything that can happen and you've got a very solid plan to address anything. Obviously, risk management and contingency planning mean planning for the unexpected or planning for something that you don't think will happen, but in case this happens, you have a backup solution in place. So we're now revisiting our, which is not to say we're changing, but we are considering the strength of our relationships with our suppliers. We're looking at contingency plans for capacity. You know that time goes on, and so we will have to face peak season. We will have to face the quarterly revenue push. So we will have to be facing the end of the year. So there will be times when we will have to continue to supply our customers with our products. And obviously, the notion of 98% means how far have we gone with our hypothetical solution. We are creating a lot of scenarios, and next to each scenario we have a set of actions that we need to take so that we know we can face uncertainties with different solutions, which can be rerouting of goods or which can be different communication standards, different communication platforms. We're using different airports if we have to. So we're really trying to build a complete scheme of solutions that give us a good level of confidence. I wouldn't say 98% or 80 or 60 or whatever, because we can be as good as we can at planning alternatives. And the association of this of these facts will tell us how good our supply chain resiliency plan has been. So we are feeling comfortable that we're doing a good work. We're doing a good job at planning as many solutions as possible to be able to respond to different scenarios with different actions that we're putting in place. Obviously, because the network is outsourced, there's also a lot of reliance on our suppliers, a lot of reliance on capacity by the airlines, a lot of reliance on capacity of the airports we are using. So we are not the only one, right? We can plan to the best of our capabilities, but we also need to have solid relationships with our suppliers. And this is why, and this is where we're putting a lot of efforts to make sure that all the scenarios are catered for and we have different solutions in place that we can plug in if the worst happens. You talked about, typhoons, for example. South of China is unfortunately very prone to those kind of events. So we had a big one last year in mid-September. We had even more the previous year. 2 years ago, we had even more occurrence of this. So we are preparing for different disruptions. And of course, the type of disruption allows you to plan differently according to the risk you are trying to mitigate.
And in terms of moving towards a more of a very practical question. One of the listeners was wondering, Which of the digital technologies, and this, you know, you name the buzzwords, right? Blockchain, AR, automation, digital twins, digital factories, whatever it may be, right? Which of them have made the biggest impact in your supply chain? And, you know, maybe from a, I don't know, from a concrete before and after cost saving or improvement of productivity or something that you could see, okay, we've managed to implement this digital transformation in one way, shape or form, and this has actually made an impact, significant or serious impact in our supply chain.
It's a very good question. I remember this came over the LinkedIn network. I think it's, well, first of all, let me just, present the case. Let's put it this way. You know, when you talk about a digital transformation, you talk about a purpose. So it's usually, I keep saying that purpose leads technology and not the other way around, which means you need to know what you want to achieve with your digital transformation before you push the button and say, okay, we're going to go ahead with the digital transformation. Do you want to change your business model? Do you want to improve performance to your customers? Do you want to have leaner processes and you want to have potentially savings in your operations or more efficiency? So of course, the type of purpose you have will guide your selection of the digital transformation aspects you want to put in place. In my view, digital transformation can be around systems, can be around hardware, can be around data, right? So we have also an important notion in Huawei, which is the fact that when you consider the make versus buy selection, whereby you say, okay, do we go and buy a solution from our suppliers, which can be hardware, which can be, you know, artificial intelligence modules, or do we actually develop something in-house? So we have a lot of inner strength. We have developed our own capabilities in-house. So we have a great team of data scientists who are developing algorithms, who are developing modeling for our own shipments. We have developed our own WMS. We have developed our own, we call it HTM, Huawei Transportation Management System. So we actually have a core strength, which is inside our company, which we have leveraged to create our own solutions. So when you say what are the biggest ones we've been, well, you know, to give an idea, we've also developed our own WMS and our own, like I mentioned, WMS and TMS. So it's a core strength of the company. So when you say, when you're asking me what are the biggest areas where we've seen changes or improvements to our supply chain, I would say probably the ones around systems. I think the systems one is the strongest one, because we have been able to create our own algorithms, our own models, and also the automation part. Although the automation is a challenge somehow, not for Huawei per se, but I think it's a challenge in general, because automation means a lot of investments. It means a lot of solid long-term relationships with suppliers. It means having clear ROI conversation with your suppliers. That's okay, what's the return on investment in terms of time? Who's going to get the benefit? How do we split the pie? So how do we split the costs? So if I look at some of our facilities, those ones where we have high volumes of, predictable volumes or relatively stable items in terms of also shape of the items we're handling, right? So it comes in full boxes, in full pallets. Then we've been able to implement very efficient solutions with AGVs, with RFID codes that are guarding our autonomous pallets around the warehouses and so on. Obviously, another component is the fact that having our own systems, we control our network. We can build models because we know exactly the flow of the flows of our goods. So the combination of automation and the development of systems has allowed us to bring a lot of efficiencies. And of course, I'm not saying we're there yet. We've not completed the work, but there's a lot of advantages we've been able to get because we can actually own our network, if I can use this terminology. We control it more efficiently, because it runs on our own platform, on our own systems, and we can access the data to develop machine learning algorithms to predict volumes or to predict movements of goods or to predict, for example, we even use it to help our warehouses to load efficiently our goods in our trucks, so we know exactly how to find the perfect balance. We can monitor the flow of our goods in transit, because we have given some of our devices that they can use for us to be able to track whereabouts of the goods. And so there's been a lot of intelligent decisions around this in terms of systems and in terms of automation, where there's a certain level of scalability, of course, which allows us to do so. Yeah.
Got you. And of course, I mean, I'm gonna ask the question also from the angle of our listeners, that, and there's a lot of them. I mean, most companies don't have the same, let's say, scale, size, and financial means. So if you were to put yourself in the shoes of, let's say, a mid-sized manufacturer, tech company, or FMCG, or whatever it may be, right? And you don't have the means to go and develop your own, let's say, tools. What would you, it's a little bit of a preemptive question, yeah, but what would you look after? I mean, what type of, and noting your point, which is a very good one, you first need to know what the business, you know, wants to do and wants
what
to achieve.
What you want to achieve, yeah, sure.
Exactly. But where would you see some low-hanging fruits in terms of technologies that can be used fairly, you know?
I think that, let's call it low-hanging fruit, probably would be access to data. I think logistics is about taking decisions. I personally think logistics is also a people business, so there's a lot that comes out of relationships, but that's a different story. There's also a lot that comes out of data. So I would say low-hanging fruit could be access to data, because data allows you to take decisions, which you can also extend to the sales guys, which you can also extend to predicting or improving your forecast accuracy. You can use data to understand exactly how to manage flows in your warehouses. You can use data to understand how to improve performance of your own network or the one that is managed by an LSP or by a 3PL. So I think the easiest of the solutions would be data. The reason why I'm saying this is because if you start thinking about investments in hardware, you need to start thinking about, okay, is this a long-term investment? Do I have the right product type that allows me to do this? If you're an e-commerce company, maybe you can do that. You invest a lot in automation. You invest a lot in conveyor belts. Peaking productivity, because of course it's a business that runs on a different dynamic based on high speed and high volumes. Of course, our business, at least the part that I represent, is more the B2B side, so it's a different one. If I were to give an advice to, like you said, an average company, I would say see what data you already have and what you can do with that data. Maybe invest a little bit in machine learning rather than artificial intelligence. And see then with supervised or unsupervised learning, what can you get from the data you already have? So you get a good set of programmers who can help you funnel the data or channel it in a way that is understandable, that is programmable, and then you can start coding and understand how you can take decisions based on the data that you already have access to, or how can you invest in getting more visibility with potentially IoT. IoT is not extremely expensive, the actual sensors themselves, but they can give a lot of added value information. At least they give you a lot of added value data. Then it's up to you to transform data into information, which means into something that is meaningful and tangible that allows you to come to an informed solution, informed decision. So I would say probably that's a more meaningful use that I would consider investing in.
Yeah, very good point. And we had another listener asking the question from a different perspective, and she was actually asking that, you know, with all the tools that you already have in your toolbox, right? You're already doing RFID, you're doing automation, you have your own systems, like you said, WMS, like you said, for TMS and a bunch of others that I'm sure that you're using. But her question was, are there actually any pain points, specific pain points left regarding logistics or supply chain? And if so, what is the biggest one that you have at Huawei right now?
Absolutely, there are, because, far from saying we're perfect, but absolutely, yes. I think, I'm thinking about probably two or three things. One is the scalability. And again, we need to always consider, like I said before, the purpose, which means what you want to achieve and why do you want to implement the digital transformation. So how can you leverage technology? What do you really want to achieve? And so how do you get technology to support you and not push technology and then say, okay, let's see what we can do with it, right? So according to this, let's say once you set up your plan, I think the challenges that we are having are the scalability, which means I have, like I mentioned before, we have some warehouses where we can run, where we can have pallets that are autonomously moving around our warehouses. They're bringing goods in and out. There's limited level of control by humans, if not, of course, the one you need to make sure that the systems doesn't get to a halt. But then again, is it scalable? Can you do it when you have to send cables to a customer, when you have to send an antenna, when you have to send goods that are maybe 20 meters long? So what level of automation can you bring there? And so is it really worthwhile, the investment? So the scalability, it really depends on the type of products you're handling, the volumes you have. Then, of course, another point, which is somehow related to scalability, is the relationships with your supplier. So do you have a supplier that you want to invest in, with whom you have a certain level of comfort that you can say, okay, guys, we want to invest for a long-term partnership. That's what we want to do. We're both investing in this solution because we think it's the one that will give us both benefits. So of course you have to consider relationships with your 3PL. We talked about, you know, you will have to probably consider a rework that is needed on the contract side, on the RFQs or on the RFP, or potentially on the already existing contract to make it more meaningful to help you with the transformation you're trying to achieve. So these are still issues that we're facing because, of course, at the same time, like any other company, we run RFQs every, say, 3 years or so, maybe 2+1 or 3+1, whatever. So do I want to invest in you if I know maybe in 3 years' time you will say, I'm sorry, Lorenzo, I'm going to go with another supplier? So we need to nurture a relationship so that this becomes a long-term partnership, not just a contractual relationship, but a really long-term partnership, so that I know that I can invest because we have both the shared long-term vision. So this is certainly a challenge. And then again, the agility. And then we talk more about leadership behaviors rather than actual technicalities of a digital transformation. For me, leadership behaviors means, do you have all the functions together? Is the digital transformation really end-to-end, or is it a digital transformation that logistics is running by itself? Is it a transformation that maybe supply chain or a part of the supply chain is running by itself? How are the sales guys using their own digital tools to improve their performance? So are we putting all these functions together? Are we putting everything into a common global platform so that we can really drive change across the end-to-end supply chain? So I don't think we are completely there yet. We are progressing, we are advancing, but we have to have a really true global vision on how we can leverage technology to help us change our behaviors, change our approach, build some silos, destroy some silos that we have across functions. And so this is still one of the challenges that is, like I said, not a technical one, it's more a behavioral one. It's more talking about change management that has to happen to greater extents to make sure that we can really get the benefits of a true end-to-end digital transformation. Yes.
Mm. And since you mentioned logistics service providers, 3PLs, or it can be either also software providers, or it can be other or you know, let's call them partners. Rina, I prefer also that term, partners in your side. One of the questions was, what would be some of the elements for successful, sustainable, partnership-driven type of a relationship between, you know, Huawei, which is a Chinese global powerful company, and one LSP? What would make it a very successful and sustainable partnership from your perspective?
Good. Well, first of all, it's a good question because it gives some meaning to my presence in the company, because I was hired from Europe to bring some value in terms of how do we open to other markets, how do we make sure we nurture, we get relationships that are more meaningful and profitable for both ourselves and our supplier base. Absolutely, good question. I'll give you an example. One of the projects that I've been running since pretty much when I came on board, we call it logistics verification. And it looks at, it's not an audit, it's not inspections, not at all. It's just a way to look at the different aspects of a relationship with a supplier. So once you've awarded the business to an LSP or to a 3PL, what do you do? Actually, even before you do that, you have to set your requirements very clear from the start. And I think a key answer to this question is, make sure you have set your requirements really clearly. And you, that means you have to have, you know, the logistics verification project looks like creating a certain level of coherence and consistency between contract, SLA, actual requirements that I have, regardless of what the SLA is, because sometimes we ask something that is not in the SLA. Then you actually get a service back from the logistics supplier, and then you finally get the payment done. So how do I make sure that these five areas of logistics are connected one another, right? So you have to have good start with information sharing. Share your strategy, share your challenges, understand what are the challenges in one country that you may not have in another country. When I travel the world, I see that we have, say, the same supplier in country A and in country B, and we have different feedback about our systems, or we have different feedback about the warehousing operations, or different feedback about how we handle relationships with them. Sometimes we even have a different contract. That means that the outcome and the value that we get from the suppliers will be different because they are guided by different contracts. So I'm talking about standardization, information sharing, use of data, because I don't think we do a good enough job of using the data that we have to transform it into meaningful information that really allows you to take decisions. And also, you need to measure what is really relevant to your business reality, because you know, you can have different contracts. You can have the famous cost plus or open books. You can have the transactional contract, or what you call it, activity based, or and so on. So different contracts exist, and you need to be able to measure what is really relevant and pertinent to your, to the relationship you have with your supplier. So, but nevertheless, I think the most important one is information sharing and being clear from the start with your requirements. Because once you have the requirements set up very clearly, you will be able to lay them down in a contract. There will be a very clear understanding from the beginning of what the expectations are. There will be a clear set of metrics that will really measure what is important to me and to you, in terms of volumes, in terms of costs, in terms of financials, in terms of performance. So we'll have a set of KPIs that will really reflect the relationship. And once you have found this openness and shared understanding of what is important to both, then you can say, okay, you know what? We like working with each other because we know exactly what our challenges are, what our opportunities can be. There's clarity in the pricing. There's no disputes, no invoices on hold, which are always generating sometimes frustrations. And then this is the best way to start creating a long-term relationship, because there's trust and there's understanding of each other's objectives. So if you translate this into the earlier aspect of digital transformation, imagine if you don't have complete clarity on the relationship, how would you be able to inject investments coming from a digital transformation, hardware systems or others, when you don't have clear trust, when you don't have clear open relationship? Who's going to invest the money? Why should I invest if I don't have full trust in your, so you know, so then you start understanding, is this really a partnership or is this more of a customer and supplier relationship? So this is not extremely conducive to excellence in logistics operations and supply chain management.
Yeah, and in some ways it's linked to where you started with on the improvement side, right? It's linked to data and you know, having clear data, being open about it, and having that partnership type of mindset when you approach the discussions. But yeah. I'll play devil advocate, because I got thrown this recently by somebody from the 3PL side. And I think the part was somewhere, actually, I don't know if it was from the 3PL side or from the manufacturing side. But anyways, the point was, he was somewhat making the case that the 3PLs are at the stage where they've heard it all before. and his point was that, because like you rightfully mentioned, most companies have that 2+1, right? 2+1 or yeah. 3 type of RFQ. Maybe it's even more frequent on the freight side. Maybe it's
just like, freight usually 1 year, yeah, could be.
Yeah, freight less and contract logistics longer. But because also from the side of the 3PL, they've heard it all before, and they are, there's a level of skepticism, right, in terms of, okay, are you serious, or am I, you know, going to make this investment and in 3 years down the line, ultimately, you know, you control the goods, so you might still make a different decision. How do you somewhat, and I'm guessing that this kind of question you might also get sometimes, but how from a manufacturer perspective, from a shipper's perspective, can you address that? And can you kind of make them realize, or make your LSP's partners, okay, clear and confident in a way that you're kind of serious, I guess. I don't know what is the real world, you know, good term to describe it, but I got a scenario where I just had to ask you, now that it can, it's just
sure.
came to my mind.
Absolutely, it's a fair question. It's not an easy one to give an answer to, but it's absolutely a fair question. I think it's important to start with transparency. So if you think about the relationship, of course, a shipper will not do logistics in most of the cases, because we say we go to the specialists, we go to those who are bringing expertise, who are bringing best practice from others of their customers, so we can leverage the best, right? But then my obligation as a shipper is to put you in the condition that you are, you know, as much as or as much as possible about my business, because I want you, you are an extended arm of my supply chain, even if you are an external supplier, but I still want you to be part of my network. So it's my ethical obligation to give you as much, to share as much information as possible with you, because it's only by sharing information that you would be able to provide a service to me that I value, that I appreciate, that I'm willing to pay for, because it's adding value to my business. So that means, like I mentioned before, being clear from the start. It means maybe starting little by little. So I'm not saying, okay, let's go with a full-blown conveyor belt system in our warehouse because that's what we think we need, assuming you need it. Why don't we start saying, okay, guys, why don't we start installing some, you know, voice speaking, for example. I was installing a lot of voice speaking solutions when I was with Honeywell before, because actually the company had bought, as part of its integration, one of those excellent solution providers. So we have had a lot of those implementations, which gave us some savings on both ends. Then we start talking about, okay, how can I improve the quality of my operations? How can I reduce cost? Again, it depends on the type of contract you have. If it's an open books contract whereby I just give you a cost plus a certain management fee, it's a different story. The availability to drive savings changes also according to the contract type you have. If it's a contract, if it's a closed book contract or activity based, I will not have visibility into how you build your rates. I just pay a certain cost per line. So then I can bring solutions that will say, guys, there's an opportunity to save costs. Okay, but then I don't know how you build your rates, but I know there's an opportunity to save X percent if you put a voice picking solution, or if you put ring scanners, or if you put light picking, or if you put some other investments. So how do we engage in a longer term relationship? Well, the point is the following. The more information you have shared, the more you show you're trusting the supplier, the more you are assessing the supplier with the right level of metrics, the more you build the culture of continuous improvement, and not just being the customer who's always right, but being the customer who needs a supplier to work efficiently so that I get in return quality service from my supplier. You cannot decide from the start how things will go, but I think it's both parties making little steps, opening up, sharing more of the strategy, sharing more of what is of value to them, what is of value to me, what do I need to measure in my own supply chain to make sure that I give excellence and excellent service to my customers, what are the key metrics that I need to measure. So you start understanding, you start measuring performance, you start having tiered accountability meetings so that you know daily, you understand what the issues are. You don't wait until the problem has become too huge to handle. So there's a certain openness in the relationship. So when you've installed a certain level of trust, then I think you can engage in a more open conversation and say, okay, guys, there's a certain level of trust. You may not necessarily be the cheapest, which has actually happened in the past in one of my previous companies, but we felt and we knew there was a certain openness in the relationship. We thought we want to stay with you because we see there's a certain value that we're getting. We don't want to just save money for the sake of saving money, impact badly our performance to our customers. So we thought, okay, let's continue the relationship. So, but this comes with time. You can't just immediately create this level of trust. So you need to start sharing more information. And this is what's bringing more trust and more mutual understanding. Because like I said, there's always a very big human component in a shipper and LSP relationship. It's not just numbers. It's not just performance. It's not just contract. But there's also a certain level of empathy that has to transpire from the relationship. And this leads to longer term investments because, you know, there's a certain level of trust. Having said that, you need to be sure that the contracts will have a lot of options laid out so that there's no surprises when something goes wrong. You will have very likely thought of the various hypotheses so that, you know, if this happens, we know what's happening. I've seen a lot of cases in my several years of experience, I'm not talking about Huawei, where there was no clarity on extension of space. There was no clarity on increase of productivity. There was no clarity on who pays, if we need to do overtime, can we do it, can we not, under what terms. So the options or the exceptions had not been thought of. And then the supplier clearly will say, the customer will clearly say the supplier is not flexible. And the supplier will say, you haven't given me enough information. How do you want me to react so fast? Because you don't share information, I cannot just provide you everything from one day to the other. Whereas the more you share or the more you build in your contract, in the various chapters you have in your contract, the various paragraphs, the various solutions you consider, the easier it will be to know what to expect. And so the more open you are, the more trustworthy will be this mutual relationship.
Yeah, and I really like what you said on the empathy and on the, well, human relationships at the end of the day side. I was talking to a global procurement leader for supply chain and logistics services for a major manufacturer, and he was sharing the same, that it had a lot to do in his decision of choosing one provider over the other. Of course, it was capabilities, of course price played a part, of course a lot of things were there, but ultimately a significant component of the decision was made based on the trust level with the person that he was dealing with, or with the team of the company that he was dealing with. Can I work with them? Can I trust them? Would they be, you know, there to work together or not? So that's a crucial element. And hopefully with all the AI and machine learning and all of those discussions, and we will end up to talking about that in a short while, but still, you know, the human side is highly, highly relevant.
Very much. Yes, absolutely. Yes.
But since we're at it, let's jump into that question now. So, I mean, the frame of the question was more or less like this. So, you know, one of our listeners was saying the supply chain in his perspective is made up of three core areas. You have procurement, you have planning, and you have logistics. He was saying that technology obviously is changing everything. And, you know, whilst on the 3PL transportation logistics side is still a lot of manpower-based activities, there are still a lot of manpower-based activities. Planning is quite readily and truthfully shaken up by all the algorithms and machine learning. Procurement is more and more being digitalized as well, and there's a lot of new type of tools out there. How are you seeing these changes specifically for this, you know, for maybe for procurement and planning? Do you see a lot of automation? Do you see a lot of people being displaced and replaced by algorithms? How's things from your perspective?
I mean, is this more of a question you see regarding the role that technology will play to replace humans, or is it more about the use of technology to support procurement or to support planning functions?
It's kind of both, right? And it's a very sensitive topic. I mean, I think whenever, and I know you go to a lot of conferences, whenever I go to conferences, I mean, I think, you know, that's probably on the mind of a lot of people, and it's a rightful fear in some ways, or reality in other ways. Depends on how you want to frame it, right? I mean, it's sure. It's happening. I mean, definitely some people are displaced. Definitely, you know, another model is man and machine, right? It doesn't have to be man against machine or man against algorithm, right? I guess it's a little bit of both.
So on the human versus machines, I think, you know, there's always been the fear that you bring a machine, it will replace the work of humans. Oh my God, what are we doing now? Certainly it's true. If you say, okay, I'm going to automate a certain process in a manufacturing line, certainly no doubt some people, unfortunately, will be, you know, will have to be replaced. If you think about even the voice speaking technology we talked about before, it brings efficiencies. It can improve not only accuracy of picking, but also actual performance. So you may end up with a certain number of operators that may have to be placed elsewhere. Let's put it this way. Now, having said that, there's also need of people who create algorithms, who do the coding. who create machines, who build the machines. So for me, it's just a shift in type of work that is happening at the moment. And so our ability to survive, let's put it this way, is to be able to continually stay ahead of the game with continuous learning, because it allows you to understand what's happening in your market, in your current role. How can I continue to remain competitive? Do I need to train myself on new skills? Do I need to upskill? Do I need to make sure my teams are trained well enough to be able to know how to use the machines that I'm bringing to support this? We talk a lot about collective intelligence when we talk about artificial intelligence, because it will be collective intelligence by machines and by humans. So I think the two will survive both. Of course, machines can replace humans, but also the same humans create the machines. The same humans create the algorithms that can help you create a fantastic planning software that allows you to predict customer demand, or they give you a fantastic software that allows you to take decisions faster when it comes to understanding the best choice for your procurement success. So I think it's where we see a part of roles being lost, being sacrificed. I think there's also other roles that are coming up which didn't exist before. If you see, there's a lot of roles now: data scientists, full stack developers, and programmers, much more than what we used to have 5, 10, 15 years ago. So that means that these are new roles, different ones, right? Different ones, absolutely, yes. Maybe the age factor is also important, because you get a new... it's probably easier to think you will find a programmer maybe fresh out of university than a 49-year-old guy like me, for example. So there's a lot of things you can consider, but certainly I don't think there would be a total exclusion of humans. Absolutely not. But there will always be new roles that humans will play. They will also consider, the humans are also controlling the machines. If you think about interpretability of machine learning, for example, which means how do you interpret the results of an algorithm? How do you justify that decision? Especially in the medical sector, you want to make sure that the physicians can explain how they came to a certain conclusion. How do they validate or not accept the solution by the machine? So there has to be a human that will have the sort of what was it you called? I think Minsk was calling it suitcase words, right? The words that are defining the ability of humans to have skills that machines don't have, right? All the soft skills that machines don't have. So this is what humans will have and will continue to have, or will continue to support the evolution, either in also in terms of transformation.
Yes, that's fair, and just to kind of challenge the statement, I mean, I think there is let's put it this way. I think a lot of people would believe that if you're fresh off the school, you're probably more inclined to pick up to pick up the new skills than if you're 49. But to be truthful, what I'm seeing, and also knowing you specifically, I'm pretty sure you would not have a problem yourself. But at the same time, there's a lot of other 49-year-olds or
sure,
people that are necessarily young. But what is happening is it's more about the mindset than it is about the... I mean, of course, age is age. But at the end of the day, now we have, you have all these free courses. You have Udemy, you have UiPath, and they have Academy.
Exactly.
Online.
Exactly.
If you really want, and if you're really determined, and you don't kind of put some self barriers in your own mind that, okay, I'm too old for this. I think that's the biggest barrier. That's the biggest danger if you're thinking I'm too old for this. But otherwise, I mean, the resources are readily available. And I mean, anybody can do it ultimately. I mean, of course, you need to kind of also find a way to then commercialize it and kind of convince people that you can use those skills. But ultimately, it's in the open. So it's a mindset thing. We're kind of looping back, if I can kind of make a summary, to soft skills, right? And to the mindset, which...
Absolutely. You need to fight complacency. You need to fight self-insecurities and say, oh my God, what am I going to do now? Well, you can skill yourself up You can take courses. I've done my bit with a couple of classes with MIT, which were really good on artificial intelligence and IoT. Another more generic one on digital disruption with IMD in Lausanne. So a lot you can do to continue to learn, to be eager, to be curious, ask questions, and try and understand what's driving certain decisions. I've come to China specifically because I wanted to improve my level of competencies because I felt I'm 47. What's going to happen in a couple of years or 3 years time? I'll be 50. What happens when you're 50? So you want to continue to be able to provide value with your experience, but at the same time with new skills that you have to learn, because that's what technology is bringing, right? Technology is bringing a level of competencies that we didn't have before. Now, if we want to stay afloat, we need to adapt and continue to learn, and hopefully this is something that will convince people to do that, because it's an interesting new world that is really fascinating. So
I'll just give an example, because I think it's highly relevant, and this topic is a hot topic, and we need to write some articles on it or something, because I think a lot of people can benefit from it. One of our clients, which is a head of supply chain for a major healthcare manufacturer, and he was saying that one of the best technical people in his team that knows everything about technology is fully, doesn't have a piece of paper on his desk and is fully digitalized and is the most advanced in terms of everything that you can think of, is a 64-year-old gentleman.
Fantastic.
Like, no wow. problem, past the retirement age, but, if he wanted to, but he doesn't want to, he wants to keep adding value. So there's really no limit. And it's a mindset game. And I just want to loop back also, because I think it's a very interesting point that you made with you and your journey. And I like to go personal, because that's a lot of value, right? Because that's your own journey. You can tell us more. And there was this specific question that we got from the audience as well, which was around you coming from a, let's call it Western type of culture to a Eastern Chinese type of a culture in Huawei. What are some of the, maybe differences? What are some of the similarities? How has this experience, in China changed the way you think, maybe more holistically about things in general? Tell us a little bit about that, because I think it's a fascinating angle to talk about.
Sure, absolutely. Yes. So, as a start, I've always been in international trade since I was a young child, right? I've always been in logistics. I was loading and unloading trucks when I was a teenager, so I've always been interested in these kind of things. I remember in 1992, I was bringing letter of credits to the bank. I was using the typewriters to write down all the information. So I've actually gone through the whole process. But I've always worked with Asia. So I've always worked with, I was importing products from Asia, then do distribution across Europe and everything. But obviously, I had never worked in Asia. So that was a very different thing when I came here. So it has taken me a long time to decide, okay, let's go. I had my nice job in Switzerland. After 17 years, I decided to jump. And it was not easy to accept this and say, okay, let's go. Let's give it a try. The reason why I did it personally is because, like I said, at a certain age, and I thought, okay, I want to continue to remain a valuable contributor to the supply chain market, and also to continually be an interesting profile for potential future opportunities. And I thought, okay, this is a great chance to add something more and real to my profile, because I thought if I go to China, I will really see China from the inside. I will not just be a person who goes to China 2-3 times a year on a business trip or so, or buy something, exchanging emails, but I will actually be working in a different context. So I did it because I wanted to grow, and I feel that I've grown as a professional and as a person. To be honest, I don't know if I had stayed in Europe, I would have taken the classes in artificial intelligence, in IoT, and maybe I would have not developed that level of interest in technology like I have. I mean, I did have a certain interest in the past, but obviously I felt much more compelled to really put more qualifications on my profile since I came here. I've also been exposed much more to technology because the company that I work for is a global leader in ICT. So, of course, you have direct access to technology, which is great. At the same time, I've grown as a person because, of course, relationships are totally different. The way we handle relationships with our suppliers is different, which is why, again, I was hired, because I wanted to sort of bring someone with a European view or with a Western view to relationships with our suppliers, someone with experience who could understand how you can standardize operations, how you can make them more consistent, how you can have relationships with the countries. But not coming from China, but coming from different countries means that you bring another perspective into the equation. So this has been the, these have been the reasons why I've chosen to come here, but at the same time that I think are of value to me as a continuous growth, but also as a value to Huawei, because they have access to a person who's got a certain level of experience in different aspects and in different cultures. So what have I learned? I've learned that, for example, I'm working for a huge company. We make $107 billion, whatever how much we made last year. But we're not a public company. So the reality of classic corporates, and most of my companies have been corporates in the past, which were public companies, means that you have every quarter the challenge of having to meet shareholders' expectations. Sometimes decisions are not necessarily the ones that you think make sense or are the most practical one, but you have to respect certain commitments to, shareholders' expectations, or the markets are pushing to see the results that you are committing to, that you've committed to. If you look at the percentage of R&D of Huawei compared to other companies, it's much higher. Well, because company can afford to decide how to invest that money. So in a way that is different from what other companies have to do, because they have different kind of obligations. So I've learned the value of being working for a big company, but having more independence when it comes to how you invest your money. I've learned the value of listening also because, and I am ashamed to say that it was one of my focal things that I had wanted to do, but I haven't done it yet, is to learn Chinese. I can only start with a few words here and there, my fault. But at the same time, this has been an opportunity for me to understand much more body language, or understand much more how to interpret people who are not necessarily very open to share their thoughts. You know, Asian culture maybe is not as straightforward, or is not as, I wouldn't say aggressive, but as open as the westernized world. So this has helped me a lot understand how do you go around the solution, how do you patiently wait for the right time, or how do you not let go, and if you propose something and it's not been accepted, how do you push back and fight for more and more attention until you get the right level of attention and the proposal gets approved or gets accepted or gets even discussed? Because sometimes you're faced with silence and you say, how do I interpret silence, right? What does that mean? Well, in an Asian culture, it's a different thing than what it is in other countries. So I've learned a lot as a professional, but also as a person, that makes it easier. Not immediately. Now I'm speaking after 2 years of experience in Huawei in China, but it's a great opportunity to learn more about yourself, how you develop as a person, how you develop as a business person, how you develop your communication skills, how you develop your cross-cultural awareness, how you develop your change management, how do you push for a solution, how do you understand that some things you cannot change them and you just have to move on, how do you prioritize differently. So these are all skills that I've learned here, and I'm happy that I've taken this decision. Of course, I wasn't happy the first 6 months. It was a very tough time because I kept looking back and I thought, oh my God, I left Switzerland. What the hell have I done, right? Still think about it sometimes, by the way. But, but it's a fantastic opportunity that I'm living here because I'm combining the professional portfolio of skills with technology, with engagement with other people, with the actual social part of the business, which means change management and influencing skills a lot. So this is good. It's a very good aspect that I think everybody should find in their lives, because it's very enriching, I think.
Mm. No, thanks for sharing that. And definitely, I mean, definitely very good and inspirational in many ways, journey. And then I think that's it's kind of linking back to what we were discussing in terms of the continuous journey of learning, right? And I mean, learning usually comes with putting ourselves in the comfortable situation or situation yes. we stretch ourselves. So that's, you know, it's interesting. And I was myself also being in Asia, living in Asia for now 11 years, I've come across some of the challenges that you've been faced with as well. And and it's interesting that the cultural awareness that also, you know, you're kind of taught to develop, which is great. And if we had to circle up and we're going, you know, we're approaching the end of the interview, and I was like, thinking also in terms of the future, in terms of we discussed soft skills, right? So we discussed the soft elements to it, the empathy, the mindset. I guess let's just call it soft skills, right? What, in your opinion, in the next 5, 10, 20, 15, 20 years are very important soft skills or mindsets that as a supply chain professional that wants to make a big career or to have a good career, one should have in order to ensure that? So not the hard skills, the soft skills.
Sure. I think you mean among the soft skills, I think the ability to learn by observing, at least based on my personal experience, I've learned a lot observing. I've always been a little bit direct in my communication style, a little bit impulsive. I've changed a lot across my 25 years of experience, but I've learned just as much in these last 2 years, because changing cultures makes you very adaptable and you accept different mindsets, different points of view. You don't question with a certain level of arrogance, I'm right, or I think this is the only way to go. So you have to learn to become much more professionally empathetic, I think you say, or empathic. I don't know how we say it in English, which means you have to be much more respectful of others' points of view, because they may not say what they think, but they certainly have a reason why they have a certain point of view. So it's up to you and your ability to network with this person to understand exactly what's driving this decision. And then you'll understand much more about the person, which is also getting to learn more about the colleague also as a person itself, not just as a work colleague. A lot of work will be done by machines. So we talked about a collective intelligence. We talked about the suitcase words that we use to define the soft skills that machines don't have that we do. So I think we'll need to be able to understand more how to drive conclusions looking at data. I don't know how to say it, but a soft skill is also the understanding of what are all the environmental factors that determine a certain situation. So it's not just pure data giving you the answer, but there would be a lot of interpretation work that we have to do, considering the more and more globalized we become, well, the more and more different environments we'll have to face. So maybe an algorithm will just give you a certain answer. If you look at the market behavior in a certain country or in two different regions, maybe the algorithm will give you the same answer or the same logic, but I think it will be up to us to interpret the data using the soft skills, which can be cultural, which can be based on gender, which can be based on environment. This market analysis is being done, which gives you a different interpretation. So our role will be, like we said before, the interpretability of data, so that we know exactly not only how to explain how the algorithm came to a conclusion, but also how to explain why you say, yeah, the algorithm goes this way, but I think we should go in this opposite direction because that's what happens in this market. That's how the markets, or that's how the product is perceived. So there will be a lot of decisions that we can take as humans that may override the decision that is coming as a first recommendation by the machine, because the machines are machines and they are not humans. They don't have the suitcase skills that we do have. So I think empathy and the ability to discern a result and understand exactly how to put it into perspective and say, okay, this is a result that I accept in this culture or in this part of the world, in this region, but I cannot accept it as such in this particular region because there's a certain different set of values that I need to keep into consideration that drive me to a different set of answers.
Yeah. No, very, very nicely said.
If you don't mind, the final one, of course, would be building relationships with people, because machines will take out or are already taking out the human components of a relationship, because you just write an algorithm, the machine runs the algorithm, poof, and you get results. Well, there's a certain component of human relationships that has to continue to exist, that will grow with value because we continue to exist. So we have to be able to work with others, and regardless of what the outcome of an algorithm will be, or regardless of how a machine is operating, we need to be mindful of other people's challenges. Like we said, there will be people losing jobs. So there's a certain level of empathy, also an understanding how relationships can help us navigate through this these times where machines are just machines and humans have much greater component to offer. We may take longer time to take decisions. Machines can immediately give us fantastic calculations that we wouldn't be able to get the results of. But at the same time, we have other skills that we need to nurture and we need to continue to grow.
Yeah. Super. Well, Lorenzo, it's been a great sharing. Thank you very much for all the, you know, for the, all the insightful pieces and of information and nuggets you have shared with our audience. And and what to wish you good luck in the next couple of months. I know that, you know, the challenges will continue to arise. So hopefully you will continue to navigate them well.
And I continue to learn. Thank you very much, Rad. It's been a pleasure, and hope to see you soon at some point again. And big pleasure to be here, and the best greetings to you and to the audience.
Thank you. Thank you, Lorenzo. Be in touch.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us on radopalamariu.com/podcast for all the show notes, links, and extra tips covered in the interview. Make sure also to subscribe to our emailing list to get the news in the nick of time. If you're listening through a streaming platform like iTunes or Stitcher and you like what we do, please kindly review and give us 5 stars so we can keep the energy flowing and get more people to find out about our podcast. I'm most active on LinkedIn, so do feel free to follow me to stay tuned for our latest articles as well as future guests for the podcast. And if you have any suggestions or any other idea, please feel free to write to me. I respond to all. And also, please make sure not to miss our next episode, where we will be having a few other C-level and top leaders in supply chain joining us. Stay tuned.